so my name is Jessica Izquierdo, which is a challenging last name to say, so thanks, Paul, for your attempts. I work with Child Fund International, which is an international NGO that works in a global alliance in over 58 countries and serving about 15 million youth and children. Today I'll be presenting on a few community-based approaches to delivering healthcare, and we're mainly looking at access, equity, and sustainability. I have no relationships to disclose, and so I'll speak just a bit about my organization. I'll provide an example from a Senegalese community health project and also speak to a child survival project in Honduras. So as I mentioned, we cover a wide range of countries globally. Our mission is really to work with the most deprived, excluded, and vulnerable. And as Shannon was saying, we're really looking to build upon those assets and to strengthen resilience. We work through local partners, so I think one of the main themes from this stream or this session is really the value of community-based organizations or community-based efforts, and so that's really the paradigm that we use. We encourage child-focused, community-based efforts as well as evidence-informed strategies, and we're also looking at those interconnected elements of change. We use a life stage approach, so that means that we're looking at healthy and secure infants, educated and confident children and adolescents, and skilled and involved youth. Within each life stage, there's a theory of change which helps us to look at domains and pathways for change. And we also use a similar socio-ecological approach, working with caregivers and other stakeholders throughout the community. So first, we'll focus on Senegal. This really amazing community health project that is still underway there. So it's a 5-year project with funding from USAID. It works in all 76 districts throughout Senegal, which accounts for nearly 9 million people, which is about 70% of the population. And the main medium for reaching these people are health huts and outreach sites. And you can see here that to date, in the third year, we have about 2,214 health huts enrolled in the project and 1,649 outreach sites. And we'll speak a bit more about what health huts are. We're working in collaboration with some critical and amazing partners, Africare, Plan, World Vision, CRS, Endograph Sahel, and Enda Health. And this is all in coordination with the Ministry of Health and with support from USAID. Now, before speaking about the project's objectives, it's important to acknowledge that we're really focusing on a few specific impact populations, these being women of reproductive age, pregnant and lactating mothers, children and infants under the age of 5, and school-aged children. Now, the principal objective for this project is looking at improving the quality of and access to information, products, and services. And we're really looking at those basic services, reproductive health, family planning, child survival, malaria prevention, nutrition, micronutrient initiatives, among others. We're also looking at fostering community ownership and improving the linkages between district and regional health teams, as well as with development agencies and community-level actors. And then, of course, we're looking at fostering national ownership. So it's fine to do a project, but we're really looking at how this project could change the national landscape, or rather build from it. So it's quite a large project, so we'll highlight just a few of the core activities that are underway. As I mentioned, we're looking at expanding the number of health huts and outreach sites. So these health huts are a layer down below those health clinics. So they're farther out into communities. They're providing access to those that are further removed. Some health huts had already existed, and we're looking to strengthen or to graduate them into providing higher levels of care. In some cases, there weren't health huts where there could be. We're also looking at training community health volunteers, but this wasn't a one-off training. It was more so looking at establishing standards of care or a standard model in which qualifications for community health workers would be upheld across the nation. And then we also looked at piloting new services and outreach strategies, as well as scaling up those that were proven successful. So an example would be the piloting of misoprostol as a postpartum hemorrhage prevention technique. Scaling up, one of the strategies that we looked at was integrated home visits, which is now being used. We then were also looking at empowering health committees. So two aspects of sustainability, which are listed on this slide here, were important to the project. One driving at the community level, and one arriving more at the policy or national political level. So looking at that community level, we are trying to empower these health committees that would support the transition of these health huts into a more formalized, higher level of care. So these health committees provided motivation to community health workers. So this could be in the form of providing, say, a plot of land to garden or a plot of land to create a home on. They also helped in running the health hut itself. So in the case that we had pilot projects such as micronutrient initiatives, they were able to use community gardens on the actual health hut site to provide demonstrations. We also then looked at partnering with the Ministry of Health and trying to really create a national policy around community health services and the formal structure that might include health huts. So in looking at what we've achieved to date, just this past year, they passed the Senegal National Community Health Policy, which outlines the key components for a community health structure and has formalized health huts being a part of the healthcare system. We also have been able to leverage this national platform to pilot some of those other interventions. So misoprostol for postpartum hemorrhage, injectables as a form of longer acting contraceptives. We are able to look at micronutrient initiatives and also Feed the Future through USAID in terms of providing some of those demonstrations. So that's one example of a community-based or community health project. And the second focus is more specifically on child survival in Honduras. So this project took place in Francisco Morazan. It was held from 2009 to 2013, and it was really looking at reducing the barriers to access, and for those that were most impoverished, or those that were the furthest removed. And so we were looking at strengthening facility-based maternal, newborn, and child health and nutrition services, and that was both to increase demand as well as to reduce those barriers, such as cost. We were looking at systemizing a new model for delivery within the health, delivery within the community, and specifically looking at increasing equity and quality. And then we also wanted to document and disseminate this new strategy for decentralization. So a key objective of the project was to really offer more accessible and affordable primary health care. And the way that we did this was through UCOS units. So these are Unidades Comunitarios de Salud. So they're basically freestanding structures that you would find in these communities. They have basic equipment, basic drugs that are available, and they're staffed by community volunteers, and they're managed by the local community, though they're also supervised by the Ministry of Health. But what's most interesting about these UCOS is that they're self-sustaining. So when the project was initiated, there were funds that were given to buy these drugs. The local committee then decided how much they were going to sell those drugs for, and that acted as a revenue-generating scheme, which allows these UCOS units to survive. And so really we're interested in how the project went. We found that it was successful in creating greater access and increased use. So we found that 21% of our target population, women of reproductive age, infants, and children under 5, were directly served by UCO sites. And these UCO sites are within 1 hour of walking compared to 3 hours or more, which is for the other health clinics. We saw that there were significant improvements in key MNCHN behaviors, so such as antenatal visits and facilitated birth deliveries. And we also recognized that the costs were much lower. So for a child under 5 years of age, a typical cost might be around $3.50 at an UCO site. That was 4 times less expensive than what you would find in a health post where there were auxiliary nurses, and it was 6 times less expensive than what you would find in a health clinic where there were doctors. So this graph really speaks to the idea of attaining equity. So at the start of the project, we sought out to serve those that were in most need and those that were the poorest. And here you're able to see that the poorest quintile is receiving and accessing services at these UCO sites. And so in summary, from the two different projects, basically we know that equity is important. So reaching those that are at the most need in creative ways that are considerate of cost. We know that access and reaching people where they are is truly important. And in sustainability, not only looking at policy level mechanisms for sustainability, but also those inherent assets, similar to what Shannon was saying, that it's possible for community-based organizations to really maintain, identify, and change the realities that they experience. And I'll just say thank you to our teams through PSSA2, USAID, and the Ministry of Health in Senegal, our Honduras Child Fund team, as well as the Secretariat of Health and USAID, and our colleagues in Child Fund Washington as well. And thank you, of course, to all those that are managing these projects day in, day out.
Some interesting questions.
Okay. As we move across different presentations and things, there's a couple of issues. One issue is the past, what is the likely future? How can we deal with complex problems and reduce them to manageable size? Is it wrong for programs just to look at just their program, so the micro level? What's really happening in communities is a lot more than just maternal and child health. As I said there's all these other things. If we're really going to look at universal health care, then we have to look at a range of things. Can things be done without donor money? Not enough funds, can't do it. The answer is, if we believe that nothing can be done without outside funds, then nothing will be done. Okay, so Hesperian Books, 100 million, is it? Or 200 million?
Well, have people reached?
Yes, it's there.
Well, okay, so there's 3.5 million copies of Where There's No Doctor Out in the World, and every book at minimum is shared with 40 people, so I can't do the math. but actually,
what Jessica and myself presented, the examples, are projects which started with a lot of outside USAID money. But I believe, I've worked in 15 different countries, mainly evaluating all these different sorts of projects. And I believe if projects are designed with sustainability in mind, certainly there is a need at the beginning, if the funding is focused, to strengthen infrastructure and to strengthen knowledge. But I believe in the long run, a lot of these programs can be sustained locally with perhaps, I'm beginning to think more and more now, a little bit of outside facilitation. And when I say outside, I mean outside the local community. So within National Health Services. So I believe that we need to think what is the outcome we're looking at in the longer term. And I think, therefore, we need to think about the role of really functional community organisations in dealing with all these problems. So we're open to any and all questions. Please, Sandy.
Included the origin, but one that you didn't put in there.
Yes, very context driven. Sorry? Yes.
I actually want to respond to that by asking another question of everyone in the room, including Paul and Jessica, which is, Paul touched on it briefly, the evidence issue. I can't tell you how frequently we are asked, where is the evidence that community-based stuff works? You know, where is the evidence of that? And I think that Paul really started to touch on this issue of moving from the bench science model of evidence-based to an efficacy and operations evidence, but I guess I would open that question back up. I think we really do have to try and do a better job of making the case for the fact that actually the only real impact sustainably is when it's connected to community-based organizing and community organizations. So it's an interesting problem that I share your concern with. I'm curious if either of you two have anything to say on that. Or
if you look at, I have and continue to be involved with the evidence-based side of things. And if you look at the whole range of studies without focusing down too much, most of the studies are what's called efficacy studies. So you have a case control and you set up circumstances. Now usually what's done is something is done to improve the compliance of the community with the intervention. Okay, so it's an artificial situation. It's not the real situation. Effectiveness studies, there are quite a few of those out there. This is what happens in the real world. So, for example, it's a couple in relationship to bed nets. That bed net distribution programs are established, and then they just looked at that program as it progressed. So, particularly longitudinal type of studies. So there is that sort of evidence. I just completed an evaluation of a rural project in Cambodia. And in my report, I argued for how important community engagement is. And there's now papers coming out in the literature that I can refer you to showing how important community engagement is. And I think that anyone here who has been involved will say that unless you engage, the program is successful and sustainable to the extent that the community is involved. So it's just a matter of, I shouldn't say what I was thinking, but I will anyway. It's just a matter of saying the appropriate language for those that provide the funds to some extent. And I think certain USAID people are coming around to seeing that community engagement makes a big difference in terms of results. Now, you know, when you say results, you know, whose results? But without complicating things, you know, I think certain people even within USAID are moving towards the need for community engagement. The other thing which you'll hear, and just to generalise, is that some people think that USAID does not support projects which address social determinants. Well, I just gave you an example of a project that did. It's a Maya multi-year assistance project over 5 years in rural Mozambique,
and it identified food security, it addressed trying to produce, improve poverty, and it addressed literacy at the same time as it addressed health. And a lot, quite often what happens is USAID will only fund, say, a health part, but NGOs like, ADRA in this case, but World Vision, also people like IDP and the non-faith-based ones, will bring in social determinants. So there is change happening, but we need to be thinking about sustainability at the beginning. There's no point putting 20 million in if the whole thing collapses when that goes away.
Continue on that, sort of maybe two different things. One is this thing of thinking about sustainability at the beginning. That is incredibly, even though some of us have been talking about it for a long time, it's still just being talked about now for projects, thinking about it. And there's been this little move to that you have to have community groups sign on to your projects. That's a little artificial at the moment because who controls the money, but at least it's acknowledging that they have to have some kind of community group support in some form, even if it's only signing on. And as some of that moves on, we're talking about sustainability and everything, hopefully that'll start driving it a little bit. But the other thing is that just this thing about the evidence, there isn't even the stories coming out because the community groups are busy doing their thing and they don't really care about so much of that. And so it never gets out, a lot of these success stories and things. Yeah, we've been doing it for 20 years, but like, well, I told them who we're getting, they don't have anyone they have to tell. There's no mechanism really for that unless they were part of some study that required it. So I think it's sort of both parts planning on it, trying to plan on it from the beginning. And some of these things, we usually think of USAID and some of these other groups as they put out the RFP and it's written in stone. There's starting to be groups, especially community organizations, that are coming back to them and saying, well, why can't we change it so it has a little bit of this in it? Why can't we, can we do this with it? And so there's starting to be a little bit of a dialogue going the other way instead of it being written in stone, coming from the donor, here's how it has to be. And so I think it's, that hopefully sometime there will be a little bit more of that coming down.
There's a website, coiegroup.org, and on there there's 80 organizations, some faith-based, some not-for-profit, that implement USAID child survival programs. But if you look on there and look at some of the different projects and evaluations there, you'll see what actually happens. So it's one thing to, what's written in the law and we won't do. Another thing is what's actually happening. I wouldn't be too depressed. There are some good results.
It's not necessarily under the same title, but with all the discussion around innovation, I think there's some shifts in paradigms for what evidence bases you need and where there's flexibility for creativity and introducing new systems. And so maybe if we're inventive, or rather maybe even traditional, and bring it back to what has worked but not as highlighted, that we'll have that opportunity.
I think the big thing about innovation. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Just one question on Jessica. When you were talking about the health hubs in Senegal, are they receiving funds from the government?
The health hubs, that's funded through the national health system.
And are you aware if they are using some of those funds to improve the infrastructure of those hubs?
So they go through a graduation system, and I'm not sure exactly where the cutoff for that graduation system, because I know that the project funds initially, right, that $40 million, is accounting for some of that transition. I don't know how much, or after that project, where that cutoff is for the funding that would come from the government. It's something that I can absolutely look at and let you know.
Thank
I don't know the divide.
Thank you. I'm asking those questions because one of the issues that I have found is working when we vote for the community compact, most of the time the work is on volunteer basis. So, I mean, that's a lack of formality for me, because that's a huge amount of work. The biggest amount of work should be recognized. And volunteer means, for example, just participating in the VHA when we were discussing for the international health section how many people wanted to volunteer or something. Most of the time we get just this silence, right? Because people just want to get things done, but they don't want to get their hands dirty. So the same thing replicates at the community. When we say community work, people think, oh, this is something simple, easy, and it's not. It's a lot of work. So my whole point here is, I think we need to continue in our interaction with people in countries, especially people from the ministries and the government, that they need to be serious about that. If they want to be accountable for the work that is done at the community level, they need to provide resources.
I think it's this thing of...
No, okay.
I think it's this thing of... I suppose some people call it capitalism. I come from Seattle, and we've had the, you know... Grandfather Gates has spoken up at times, and he says, well, you know, the answer is capitalism. And they think... I mean, my understanding is they think the people will only do things for when they see there's a benefit to them personally, in a commercial sense, I guess, in a monetary sense. Well, I guess that's true. I mean, you know, we're all here, we've all got our own motivation. But if we're, shall we say, a little bit informed in our approach, we can see that it doesn't have to be just us that benefits. So, for example, bringing out new innovations like mHealth and different approaches to things. If people are thinking, oh, we know, we'll take these to developing countries and we'll sell them and make a profit, okay, well, yes, I mean, I wouldn't say, you know, 100% no to that, but the thing is, well, what is the real, how does that fit in with the community's needs? And how, why will that not be just taking scarce resources away from what people might use for just for food, for example, for children, etc. So it's this thing of, yes, okay, there's self-interest, and we need to look about what motivates people and how can we raise that motivation. But at the same time, a lot of countries, a lot of people think about the benefit to the family, to the group, more so than, say, capitalism does. And so I think this, the mores, you know, does influence what happens. Consultative process, that communities themselves will identify what who should be compensated and how much. And I think most communities, someone who is, for example, integrating delivering integrated community case management. That's really, you have to be available 24 hours a day. You have to have a certain amount of skills. And I think most communities I've involved with would say, well, that person should be compensated. Now, whether the community can do it or whether that's something the government should be doing, you know, that's sort of clear. Now, another worker, they're a sanitation worker. They go around from house to house and they educate the family about hand washing, about clothes washing, about care of the latrine, and perhaps follow up with the well committee, the committee maintaining the well. Someone like that might work for a couple of hours a week because, you know, the main income is from somewhere else. And the community, you know, as a group, the community would say, oh, that person, you know, they should be acknowledged within the community, but they don't need to be paid, and they get, you know, it's a service to the community, to the family, gives them status. And so I think more and more we involve the community into what works locally, you know, not sort of saying, you know, there's going to be a million health workers and all going to be paid. That's bound to fail because it's horses for courses and what is sustainable.
And implementing these projects directly in my current job. But what I can speak to is some innovative approaches I've seen strengthening referral. Actually, Belize has a very interesting model. It's a small country. I think they have a lot of advantages that make this possible. But it has quite a geographic distance to care outside of the capital. And through pretty heavy pressure from their Ministry of Health, they adopted a situation where when people come to the clinic or a hospital for care, they're given a referral slip back to a community health worker. So that referrals actually work the other direction, which when you think about it, is actually the most logical way for referral to occur. Because the community health worker is then charged with doing the follow-up and support. But what it's had as an effect is by reversing the dynamic, it made the providers respect the role of the community health workers, and it created a greater valuation of the relationship between community health worker and provider in the clinic. I don't have the statistics, but it's resulted in much more effective referrals working from community to clinic, but also then, again, clinic back to community. And I think it's a model that has some promise for adoption in other places. So I guess I can speak to that. But admittedly, it is one of the hardest things. Part of it is infrastructure. Part of it is the way doctors and providers are trained, and trained in a way that doesn't have them respecting the role of community health workers. And I think that's area that we all need to work on.
The other question? Anyway, you talked about tobacco control and the problem in China. I know it's not only China, there are so many other places. But I visited the French Quarter here. In their own countries, and they come to such a place, and the whole place is filled with smoke. I don't know, are there any programs going on for places like New Orleans to curb such problems?
Yeah. mean, tobacco can be a very political thing because, you know, getting votes and local tobacco industries and things. Some countries have even used international tobacco control policies to promote trade against the interests of local national policies. And so tobacco, I mean, any major health problem can be, when there's a commercial element, can be manipulated in many different ways because of many different players. And so advocacy is an important part of health. And how to do it, and is also something to be very, takes a bit of nuance as to what to say and when. But yes, certainly. Give you a lot of examples which would put you, get me into trouble, but so I won't. One of the things in the international health section, and of course in APHA widely, we deal with trade and health. And if you're interested in this area, I would certainly talk to Marianne Mercer, who's our representative from the international health section. But there's also I think it's a forum or something. It's something that people really need to get learn a lot more about. You know, foods, practically anything that goes across borders, including medicines, can be political because of people can make profits out of it. At the moment, there's a big Trans-Pacific Partnership is a big treaty which is being negotiated at the moment between the US and various other countries. There's a lot of health things in there, a lot of health things.
It's called the Health and Trade Forum.
That's the one, yeah. But, for example, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, if it goes through as is, will increase the price of drugs in many countries. And there's obviously implications. So, we're up. We've got 5 minutes to go. If you've got no more questions, we can you can end early and come up here and ask Sarah all sorts of questions and buy all of those books.
Visit our booth, 1503, there's a sale.
just to do a bit of advertising, since that's part of my role. The International Health section has a luncheon today at 12:30. Now, it's a sit-down luncheon, you know, which you have to pay for. But if you don't want to do that, and I don't know whether there's any tickets left, you can come along at 1 o'clock and sit in the back and listen to the talk. And the person who's talking today is the Dean of Tulane, Pierre Bouquin. And then the title he's talking about, which actually should be quite interesting, is Are We Globalizing Global Health? What is written here is there's an increasing consensus that global health should link domestic and international health issues and solutions. By contrast, most academic programs in global health are still focused on low-resource countries only. The challenge is to globalize global health without losing the emphasis on the most deprived populations. So it should be quite interesting. Very good speaker, and his slides are good. I've already seen his slides. But it should be interesting and provocative, because I think we need to deal with a lot of the problems in the US need to be dealt with in a global context. And I think we need to educate the US population about a lot of things in order to
produce change here and overseas. So I invite you all to come along at 12:30, and it's in it's R023. Okay, so if no more questions, thank you very much. Thank our speakers here, and thank you very much for participating.